Margaret Weir, a professor of political science and international and public affairs at Brown University, visited the London School of Economics on March 15, 2016. She delivered a lecture on the politics of spatial inequality in metropolitan America.
So let's go ahead and get started. I'd like to welcome everyone here this evening. My name's Peter Tribowitz. I teach in the International Relations Department, and I'm the director of the U.S. Center here at the LSE, which is sponsoring tonight's lecture. So one of the things the U.S. Center tries to do is promote deeper understanding about American politics, American society, and few issues have drawn more attention in recent years than the problem of economic inequality. It's an issue that the U.S. Center plans to shine a bright light on going forward. And with that in mind, we invited tonight's speaker, Professor Margaret Weir, to help us better understand the politics of inequality and also the possibilities, the political possibilities for addressing it and alleviating it. Professor Weir is professor of political science and international public affairs at Brown University and a leading expert on urban politics and comparative social policy. Before joining Brown, she taught at the University of California, Berkeley, where she wore multiple hats. I can't tell if it's two or three, as the Avis M. Saint Professor of Public Policy and a professor of sociology and political science. She was in both the soci and political science departments there. She's the author and editor of six books, dozens of articles on topics that really that range from welfare reform to regional development to public education. She's also racked up an impressive array of awards and grants over the years, including grants from the MacArthur Foundation, actually multiple grants from the MacArthur Foundation, the Robert Woods Johnson Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Russell Sage Foundation, among others. She's currently working on a book that is entitled Out of Sight, Out of Mind, Marginalizing the Poor in Metropolitan America. That's not the title for tonight's talk, or it wasn't the title for tonight's talk, but it is the title for tonight's talk, or it's close to the title for tonight's talk. I'm really pleased that we were able to get her to make the trek from Providence to London. And in that connection, I also want to just, you know, give a shout out to the U.S. Embassy here in London, which has really very generously provided support for our speaker series this year. We really couldn't have done this without their support. For those of you on Twitter, the suggested hashtag is LSEUSINEQ for inequality. I would ask you to, you know, please put your phones on silent if you haven't already. The event is being recorded, and hopefully it will be made available as a podcast in the pretty near future. So with that, please join me in giving Margaret a very warm LSE welcome. Thank you.
Well, I'm really pleased to be here. Thank you, Peter, for the invitation and all your efficient and effective staff at the LSE Center. Thank you so much. This is about American politics, and if you're like me, you're thinking, what is happening in the primaries today? So I want to tell you, just from the start, take Trump out of your mind. I'm going to mention his name once in this talk, but only once. So you have to take Trump, put him over here for now. So I'm going to talk to you about something different, which is my research related to spatial inequalities and the new political geography of poverty in the U.S. And as you can see, I still haven't decided on a title. I'm playing with different titles, and if you have suggestions, they would certainly be welcome. And I will certainly welcome your comments at the end of the talk because I'm in the process of writing it and thinking about these issues. So let me start with a story. And this is something that happened in 1995. And a young woman named Cynthia Wiggins, she was a young African-American mother living in the city of Buffalo, if anyone has ever been to Cheektowaga in a suburb of Buffalo. She lived in the city of Buffalo in an African-American neighborhood and worked out in this high-end suburban mall. And actually, I learned about this story because I was working at Brookings, and I got a call from someone asking me to comment on it. And the story was that the buses from Canada were allowed to come into the mall so they could do shopping there. But buses from the city, the inner city of Buffalo, had to drop people off on the other side of the thruway, so they had to walk over 8 lanes of traffic. And she was killed by a truck as she was crossing those lanes. And the story stayed with me because here she was, a young woman, a young mother, doing exactly what public policy wanted her to do. She was working. And what was happening at the local level was that barriers were in her way, were making it harder for her to work. And so that, in a way, is kind of an inspiration for the argument of this book, sort of the central argument of the book, which is that our national policy has assumed, focuses on individuals, it assumes mobility, it assumes that organizations will get created in places where low-income people live. It is not a place-conscious policy. And that shift has only become more and more intense since 1995, because the period when this happened was even before welfare reform. So on the one hand, you have this very individualistic, work-oriented, assuming mobility kind of federal policy, and on the other side, there's a set of subnational, political, and institutional realities that use political boundaries to separate people by race and by class. And it's not the old picture of a city versus suburb, a black city versus a wealthy white suburb. It is a much more complex and new political geography now, and a very limited structure for mobility. So this disjuncture is kind of the starting point for the talk that I want to give. How is it that it came about, and how can we think about changing it? So the research that I've done for this project uses a variety of different data, mostly descriptive data in the project, some archival materials, and examinations of federal policy design and trying to understand how they actually operate on the ground. And I have case studies of 3 metros, and I'll make reference to a few of them during this talk today. My goal in looking at Chicago, Atlanta, and Houston is to get this picture of metro areas that are organized differently spatially. At least historically, they've been organized differently spatially, so that places in the Northeast and the Midwest separate people using political boundaries historically. Historically, places in the South used formal racial barriers to separate people, and places like Houston just grow by annexation, and they're more sort of free market. So I wanted to build in this contrast of different types of governing arrangements and see what is the new political geography that is being created and how does it fit or not fit with our policies. So what I want to do in the talk today is to do 3 things. First, to give you a sense of how and why federal urban policies were transformed after the 1980s. So give you a sense of what the federal piece of it is. Then look at what I call subnational separatism and the new metropolis. What is the new metropolis, and how does it work to separate people by race and by income? And then briefly look at some federal policies and see what difference they make or don't make? Do they help to mitigate some of these differences, or do they just simply let those differences that are created at the subnational level drive local experience? So let me start with how did we get here? And I'm skipping this slide. So what I want to start with is this decline of the New Deal coalition. And the thing I want to emphasize here is that the United States is different from most European countries in the sense that it is states, not the federal government, that has authority over local governments. So the American federal government cannot go in and rearrange metropolitan areas so that they have a better fit with the wealth, with what their responsibilities are under the welfare state, or rearrange them to make sure that local localities can actually fulfill basic service delivery options. That's really a state role, not a federal role. But the New Deal coalition found a way around these legal arrangements that kept a federal government hands off. And the way they found a way around it was by establishing direct ties between the federal government and local governments that was based on the political power of mayors. And that power was power that was brokered through the party system. Mayors played an exceptionally important role in the New Deal Democratic Coalition and in Democratic politics because they controlled a large block of voters. And those voters could be reliably delivered on election day. And sometimes they would deliver dead voters. You know, sometimes they would, how many votes do you need? Well, deliver them. So, I mean, it was an arrangement where they were important in part because they were unified and strong and could deliver votes. And this is a picture of the U.S. Conference of Mayors in 1971, kind of the last gasp of the power of mayors. And if you recognize anybody there, you see there's only one African-American mayor, that's Ken Gibson of Newark, and the handsome one is John Lindsay of New York, people who look at history of American politics. But so the U.S. Conference of Mayors played this critical role, and what it created was federal urban policy. The result of that political importance was federal urban policy. And I want to characterize that policy because that's what changed. So what that policy did was it was compensatory. What federal urban policy did was to expand the local public sector, provide a cushion for local governments that had disproportionate numbers of low-income people in their boundaries. Over time, it did more than just cushion through extra federal resources, provided levers for low-income people, for minorities in cities to challenge unresponsive local governments. So those of you who study international politics and this idea of a boomerang model where NGOs can get power from outside to challenge unresponsive governments. It's pretty much how the war on poverty worked in the United States. The federal government gave resources directly to low-income communities, and they could then build power to challenge unresponsive local governments. So compensatory plus levers that enable local activism. But a third thing about federal urban policy is that it can be characterized as compensatory but also containment. Did not challenge the boundaries and the racial boundaries established by local political boundary creating. It mostly left a kind of patchwork of metro areas with cities and suburbs divided by income and by race. It didn't challenge that. But urban policy, I mean, in some ways, you know, may be seen as something that government should always do, but because it rested on this distinctive political set of relationships, and those party brokered ties, once those began to attenuate, urban policy was in trouble. And they began to attenuate in the 1970s and really collapse in the 1980s for a variety of reasons. One is that the American population increasingly moved to the South and the Southwest, where many of the mayors were Republicans or nonpartisan, so they weren't going to be delivering votes. They didn't have the same kind of party machines that were more characteristic of the older urban centers. And the other thing is that political parties changed. So we began to do primaries through direct elections rather than having party bosses sit in smoke-filled rooms and decide who were going to be the candidates. So that distinctive power that mayors had declined, and with it, urban policy declined. And two other things happened. Mayors then began to change. And even mayors in these older cities, they became much less interested in achieving their goals through political ties and through political relationships to the federal government, and they became much more place entrepreneurs, selling their place in the marketplace of cities that are competing with one another, and much less attentive. So groups like the U.S. Conference of Mayors still exist. Every year they put out a report on homelessness, but they are kind of a shadow of their former selves. And Republicans have a very different orientation to patronage than Democrats of this earlier era do. So whereas Democrats, in a sense, were interested in patronage and sending resources to places where they had party ties, Republicans have a kind of place-less patronage system, where patronage goes to firms that they're close to. So they have kind of a contract patronage system with firms that's not place specific. So it's very interesting that in recent years, the Republican Party has gotten rid of, earmarks, which are one of the ways to, you know, send special goods to places. I think the thing is that they care less about place because they're much more ideological and oriented toward firm. So the result of kind of the pulling back from federal policy was a much more hands-off kind of federal policy, and this is what I described earlier. So in housing, you go from actually building public housing in particular places to sets of vouchers, tax incentives, no funding to help create organizations, nonprofit organizations that create public housing. Those are community development corporations. In the 70s, the government provided funds to help them going. They eliminated those funds. A social services block grant, which doesn't actually help create organizations on the ground. It just sends the money to the states and assumes that those capabilities will emerge somehow. And then finally, TANF, which is the Temporary Assistance to Needy Family, or welfare, as it's colloquially called, just about ended cash assistance. Very hard to get cash assistance in the United States if you're poor now. And in some states, it hardly exists. And it assumes access to employment. So we have a very work-oriented welfare system in the United States starting in the 1990s on. So it was also accompanied by reductions in place-based spending. One of the biggest federal grants that goes to places is the Community Development Block Grant. And you can see that it declines in the 80s. And Ronald Reagan really was the one who got rid of urban policy in a sense. It was not his constituency. The cities were simply not his constituents, and he wouldn't suffer politically by reducing this. So it's basically been cut in half. You can see the big surge that was the stimulus in the Obama administration when they ramped up spending to help the economy, but it's gone back down again. social service spending. So this is a social services block grant and TANF. That is a story, again, you see a little blip up during the recession with this special government stimulus, but basically a trajectory going down. So not only did policy focus on the individual, reduce spending, there's another significant thing that it did, which is it reduced the federal levers so that activists on the ground who were trying to do things to support low-income people had fewer kind of things to grab onto that would turn that off. Thank you. That's happened to me. So fewer federal levers. So federal government isn't out there with requirements for participation, civil rights laws, funds to support organizational creation, all the things that helped activists to try to challenge the inequalities. They haven't totally disappeared, but they're much less strong than they once were. So the repercussions of this is that in place of this kind of party-brokered relationship that connected the bottom to the federal government, we have this set of kind of, I don't want to say random nonprofit organizations, but we have kind of an array of nonprofit organizations that grew up after the war on poverty. They are trying their best to address issues of poverty, but most of them have a very ad hoc networks in terms of, you know, what kind of connections they have outside their very specific narrow area. They have very limited vertical leverage, and by that I mean most of them don't have the capability of going into higher levels of government, either the state or the federal government, to try to change something to make their local work easier. And most of them don't have very strong horizontal reach, and I'll talk more about that. But it means that as poverty spreads out, you have organizations that may have started in the city and they have limited kinds of capabilities beyond that node where they first got established. They often have very precarious funding. So their funding is largely from the federal programs that continue to exist, the social services block grant and some of the housing money. But they also rely on philanthropy. Labor does a little bit, and I'll say a little bit more about labor at the end. So we're left with a really different kind of set of organizations that are out there to try to do advocacy around issues of spatial inequality. And I want to segue now. They're doing it in a very new kind of political geography of poverty. And that's in some ways what I just gave you my historical chapter, and now what I want to move to is a sense of, well, we know the old story of, you know, black, poor city, well-off, white suburb. I think there's great histories of that, but we know a lot less about our current situation in terms of the political geography. So one piece of it is rising suburban poverty, and the Brookings Institution, Elizabeth Kneebone, have done great work on describing this rise in suburban poverty, and this is based on their analysis. It's around 2008 or so, the numbers of people who are poor in suburbs became higher than the numbers of people in cities. But the rates of poverty are higher in cities. So you have the situation that some the media has picked up the idea that poverty is suburbanized in the United States. And it's not, that's not exactly the right way to put it. The right way to put it is that it is a much more complex situation in the United States with poverty in the suburbs, but still patterns of deep need within many urban areas. And so a lot of people have now begun to try to make sense of this complexity, like how can you, what's the right way to make sense of some of this complexity? And there's a number of typologies that people have developed, and they're often looking at demography or economics to try to characterize different kinds of places where there are poor people, or especially to characterize suburbs where there are poor people. And so I am trying to enter this this kind of area of inquiry by suggesting a typology that is more focused on organizational and political endowments and fiscal capacity of places. So rather than kind of characterizing places by their economic or demographic characteristics, I want to focus on political jurisdictions and think about what are the endowments that political jurisdictions have, and what capacities do they have or not have to deal with poverty. So fiscal capacity is kind of obvious. We know that's important. Local governments in the U.S., even the most generous, don't spend a lot of money on poor people, but they provide lots of other services that can vary and have a lot to do with the quality of life. So they provide police, fire, water. We know now in the case of Flint, Michigan, that some localities in the United States, I mean, this was a decision by the state government, but that in efforts to become more fiscally prudent, provide poisoned water to their communities. But those basic services, they can include things like libraries, et cetera, are critically important, and they vary a lot by place. The other thing that fiscal capacity does, it's connected to also administrative capacity. So some places with low fiscal capacity, they don't even have economic development agencies. So they can't write grants to get money from the federal government. They're just kind of hanging out there on their own, not doing very much because they don't have much capacity. Organizational and political endowments that I'm thinking of are both sets of nonprofit organizations that deliver services, but also political organizations that can advocate on behalf of low-income people, you know, either in that area or outside that area. So it is a two-by-two table, and here it comes. So this gives us four different kind of places. I'm only really interested in, I'm interested in all of them. But so the first one are large jurisdictions in the northern and midwestern cities. And these are places like Chicago, New York. They have strong organizational and political endowments, in part because historically this is where the war on poverty was fought. Many of those organizations still exist. They established things like public transportation, so transit, in an earlier era, and so they have a relatively strong public infrastructure. The big fight in these places is, can that public infrastructure serve low-income people, or is it all being devoted to gentrification? So they have this very specific kind of conflict. They potentially have relatively high fiscal capacity, in part because they include diverse people of diverse income. So think New York, you know, billionaires and millionaires. That's a bad joke, sorry. But let me say something that, you know, I have this on a, I'm going to show you boxes, but it actually should be thought of more as a, you know, as a continuum with across, so that you might have a city like New York up here with lots and lots of organizations and lots of fiscal capacity, and then a place like Detroit that actually, to tell you the truth, still has a fair amount of organizations. In part, it's the philanthropic organizations in that area that help bail out Detroit. So even though you think of Detroit as having nothing, it has a legacy of an earlier era where it did have those organizations. But there's room for movement here that it's not, like, fixed. So that's the first piece of my typology. The second place are Sunbelt cities and counties. And, you know, when people study urban politics in the United States, they usually don't study the Sunbelt. You know, no one wants to go to Houston. And so people don't tend to study Houston. But, in fact, that's the growing part of the country. This is the part of the country that people, this is where opportunity is. In fact, Houston is like one of the largest immigrant centers in the U.S. now. It's crazy, but it's a very vibrant place that is governed very, very differently from the cities in the Northeast and the Midwest. And these are places that have substantial fiscal capacity because they include people from different income backgrounds, but they tend to have low organizational and political endowments. They did not experience, their histories are extremely different. They did not create things like public hospitals. They don't have public transportation systems historically. They're car cities. And so the big challenge in these places is, I mean, the biggest challenge is, can you ever get them to pay attention to low-income people? So it's good that they're that it's a larger jurisdiction with more potential for redistribution, but can the voice of low-income people ever be heard so that these places are attentive to it? And I call them segmented suburbs because, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But so these are big Sunbelt cities and also big Sunbelt suburbs, and often you can't really tell the difference between big Sun. You know, Houston doesn't look very different from Houston suburbs; they look similar. So the other thing about these places is that they will often just be resistant to the idea that poverty exists in their place, and that is really an out of sight, out of mind kind of phenomenon. My third place are what I call extrusion. And these are small, distressed suburbs. They're often on the outskirts of a metropolitan, or they're often inner suburbs in metropolitan areas. So the south suburbs of Chicago include some of the poorest suburbs, I think the poorest suburb in the United States, historically African American. The south suburbs of Los Angeles, formerly manufacturing area, car manufacturing area, now full of very low-income immigrants. That's also what I would characterize Ferguson, Missouri, where the Mike Brown killing took place as this kind of small jurisdiction. These places have special problems. One is that they're very vulnerable to racial tipping. The fact that they're small means that you can get very rapid shifts in what the population is as whites leave and sort of fail to move into those places. And that's what you've seen in a lot of these inner suburbs. But in some ways, these places are like the worst of all worlds in the sense that they have very low fiscal capacity and they have very low organizational and political endowments. They're small. They don't, and especially if they're new, if they're new places where low-income people live or have undergone racial transition, their history is not a history where the war on poverty helped to build some organizations. Their history was as, you know, sort of middle-class, lower-income, lower-middle-income suburbs. And so one of the things that they do, we've learned a lot about ever since the Mike Brown killing, is, you know, one of the ways they get revenue is by putting their citizens in jail for traffic violations and charging them for traffic. You know, it accounts for something like 40% of the income of some of these cities, the Justice Department reports were showing. So, and then finally, there are affluent suburbs which use their power of zoning to prevent poor people from living there. So they can use their power of zoning to eliminate or to prevent multifamily housing from being built, large lot zoning, kind of typical tools to limit the limit low-income people. And they have a, I have scarcity, because they have a scarcity of low-income people. So that's my typology. And what?
Why have to say low voice?
The rich suburbs?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I'm not sure they actually belong there. You know, for a while I had something else on here. For a while I had size of jurisdiction here, and they're often smaller. So I might go back to size of jurisdiction. I've been kind of playing back and forth with what's the better way to think about it. Well, you know, and I'm going to say something about that in the I see that particularly in the segmented places, but it's a good question. I've been sure that this is what I want, but I've been kind of playing with this dimension in terms of thinking about, you know, what is it that I really want to capture in that dimension. So in fact, most of those jurisdictions, they have the fiscal capacity. They have the fiscal capacity. Whether they ever use it for anything is sort of another question, whether they really do have any kind of strong public sectors. So thank you, yeah. So one of the questions that I'm asking is, well, what's going on? How are these places getting created? What are the dynamics? This is our new metropolis. What is creating our new metropolis? And so some of the things are things that we know about. White flight, immigration, large-scale immigration has altered the United States dramatically. New home ownership opportunities. Some of what is creating this is not bad. It's people in cities who are looking for the opportunity for home ownership. So they move to the suburbs. That's often the case with African Americans, you know, seeking a better place to live. Gentrification, some of it's pushing people out and altering cities. And this kind of explanation highlights individual choice, that it's really, you know, choices that people make. It's true, immigrants decide to move to suburban areas often because they want to be closer to jobs. So there is individual choice involved in this. But what I want to emphasize is that a lot of this individual choice is conditioned and shaped by public policies. And so there's three public policies at the subnational level that I want to highlight and spend a little time talking about here. And so one of the things that creates these places and conditions these individual choices is there are plenty of opportunities for exit. You don't like who's moving into your neighborhood, you can find an alternative place. A second way that public policy assists in what I call defensive localism. You can segment the public sphere to limit your own exposure to low-income people. And finally, sort of the most direct is to use public policy to expel low-income people. So I want to go into each of these in a little bit more depth and show you how they work. So in terms of exit opportunities, one of the key things about the United States is that we just keep building housing. It doesn't matter how many households there are in the metro area. We just keep building housing. So this is a picture of, you know, the from 2000 to 2010 of the number of the growth of households compared to the growth of housing permits. And you can see that both in Atlanta and Chicago, the number of new housing permits way outstrips the number of household formation. And what this means concretely is that there is always a new supply of housing on the fringes, where if you don't like where you are, you can move to a new place. You know, my brother lives in Houston, and he said, well, you know, I don't want to buy a used house. I had never heard the expression before, a used house. But that, you know, they think about housing in a really different way. So let me say a little bit about how that has affected a place. It really affects places that I call extrusion. So these very low-income suburbs. So one of the places I've been studying is in the Atlanta region, and it's Clayton County, which is it's a county that's south of the city of Atlanta. And Clayton County in 1980 had an 8% poverty rate, and it was 91% white. And by 2015, it had 23% poverty rate and was just about 19% white. And I had the earlier data, and that transition occurred earlier. So you don't have to go to 2015. You know, you can look at 2010. It had a very quick racial turnover in this place. And Atlanta is one of the places where it is always growing. The white population is increasing. I think they're going to end up in New York. It is increasingly just, you know, growing outward and outward with no barriers. And that's what's happening to the white population. So you have these places. And one of the reasons that African Americans started moving to Clayton County is that you could buy affordable homes there. So you had middle-class African-Americans moving there in hopes of something better, and instead you got a kind of a racial tipping phenomenon. And the result has been a very, very weak public sector during the recession. Clayton County had to eliminate their bus service. They're located way down here. Most of the job centers of the Atlanta area are up here. There's no public transportation to get there, and the small bus system that they had was eliminated. Their school board also lost its accreditation because there was some corruption. This is a very weak public sector in these kinds of places, mostly run by county government, which is not a very effective or strong government. Very similar story, but kind of a different political geography in Chicago's south suburbs. Not a big county government, but lots of small jurisdictions. These are some of the poorest suburbs. Also racial, see the racial tipping that has occurred. These are 28 different towns. And very high poverty rates. Harvey, Illinois, 34%. These places were heavily hit during the recession. So that's the story of the exit opportunities. I want to turn to talk about defensive localism. See, I have an enthusiasm for this topic that may cause me to talk for a long time, but I will try to rein it in. So segmented suburbs, this is a picture of an Atlanta suburb where the low-income people typically live in these sort of low-slung apartment buildings. And so how do they operate? Most of the way that they separate low-income people who live in these apartment buildings from the richer people is through a very weak government and private governments, homeowners associations. So most of the middle-class people are in homeowners associations and get services privately, and then the county government is quite weak and provides kind of, you know, lower levels of services, or it may do significant economic development, but it doesn't provide social services typically. One exception to this rule, and I'm just going to talk a tiny bit about it because I have found it so fascinating. One exception to this rule of counties that started providing lots of social services and redistributing money were two counties. Let me get my map. Fulton County, which is Atlanta, the city of Atlanta, but it goes up into some very wealthy suburbs, and DeKalb County, which is over here, they started providing more generous social services and doing what you can do if you have fiscal capacity, redistributing among people. And what has happened there, and it's totally fascinating, is that they have started to adopt a form of defensive localism which is much more characteristic of northern cities than these southern cities, which is they have started to create new political jurisdictions of wealthier areas. And historically, they weren't allowed to do this, but when Republicans took over the state legislature for the first time since Reconstruction in 2005, you had a rash of new city formations. They changed the laws so that these places could essentially shield themselves from low-income people. So these are just some of the places that got created since that time, and there are more since then. And they insist that it has nothing to do with race, it has nothing to do it just has to do with their need for autonomy. But this is an example of the semi-coded, I don't know if that's actually coded racial language, that was used in La Vista Hills, which did vote this past November to form a separate political jurisdiction. Three guys who think it's too late to wait. So, and then when you look at who is in charge of these new cities, I forgot to say one thing. DeKalb County and Fulton County were governed by African Americans. It was African American leadership in those counties that created more generous social services. Who is in the leadership positions after you create these separate political jurisdictions? A bunch of white guys. So it's a way to change the political, what government will do, what it will supply, and a way to segment the public sphere. The final strategy is to expel the poor. And these are also, this is from Atlanta. They used to have these towers that said, Gwinnett is great and success lives here, the kind of suburban ideal. Now that county has doubled the poverty numbers than Atlanta. It is a big, big county. And just by being big, it has that many more poor people. So what these places often try to do is expel the poor using the power of local law. So the use of housing codes, for example, where you try to prevent immigrants from living, you evict immigrants because they have too many people in an apartment. What they are also doing in these new cities in Atlanta are doing this is they tear down the affordable housing and using housing codes as an argument for tearing down the affordable housing. And Waukegan, Illinois, which is a deindustrialized suburb, and now it is kind of a suburb of Chicago, has done something that a lot of the places all over the country has done. It started towing the vehicle, an aggressive towing program, so that people who are undocumented immigrants, there were a lot of undocumented immigrants that live in Waukegan, would lose their cars because they couldn't go to reclaim it because they didn't have a license to reclaim it. So basically it was a way for people to, a message like, don't come into our town, stay away from our town. And that's a strategy that has been used in a lot of different places in the U.S. to just prevent low-income people from coming into your place. So the question is, we've got these strong levers at the local level for separating people by race and by class. And the question is federal policy doing anything about it? And I just want to, I'll go through this pretty quickly because I've already kind of signaled at the beginning that my argument is that federal policy isn't doing very much. And of course, social services and transportation are critically important in a context where you have a very work-oriented welfare state. You need the services. If you lose your job, you may be evicted. You need something to tide you over. You need transportation to get to your job. And my answer is essentially that there are very few ways in which federal policy is helping to remedy or mitigate inequality, the spatial inequalities. So social services, I mean, they provide this large array of assistance, a variety of things that are really important for low-income people. But you can see, and we charted kind of where they are in poor suburbs and in richer suburbs. And they have really not managed to get out of their historical places of strength. So you have places like, and that's the Clayton County, that suburb I told you about that had the racial transformation over over that 20-year period. This very, very low capacity in terms of actually delivering services to low-income people. So that means basically people have to go into Atlanta, which then puts a greater burden on the services that exist there. Similar story, these are two more affluent suburbs, but still with very small kinds of capabilities in terms of their nonprofit sector. This is a measure of the nonprofit organizations that serve low-income people in these areas. And let me just really, I've said this when I started talking about it, but these organizations, these nonprofit organizations, they have they may be strong in some very narrow senses, but they don't have any power to go up to the federal government and change laws to make their local activity more effective. And most of them don't have a lot of horizontal reach. So it's not that possible for them to say, well, we're going to, you know, we see there's poverty out here in this area 30 miles from us. Let's see if we can't spread out there. Very difficult for them to do that. They also have defined their missions very narrowly. They more focus on remedying the causes of poverty rather than joining in coalitions around things that would actually help eliminate poverty, like the Fight for 15, increasing minimum wages. And I'll just say one word about public transportation. Transportation is, you know, critically important, and where you really have seen transportation inside cities, the big issue is, will money be spent to create transport for in support of gentrification, to get middle-class people into nice transit subway systems, or will it be used for the people who depend on bus service or depend on the subway? This is kind of the critical question in places all over the country. It was a big issue in Los Angeles, and there was an organization in Los Angeles called the Bus Riders Union that actually successfully challenged the effort to put a lot of money into a new system that would go up to areas that were middle class and white, and they were going to charge the bus riders, who are predominantly very low income and people of color, to pay for this. They're going to raise the monthly rate to pay for this. And this organization did successfully challenge that and got a consent decree. So this is kind of an example of, you know, being able to use a lever from the federal government. And it's the Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which says that you can't discriminate in public facilities that are, you know, funded by the federal government, which transportation is. The problem is that there was a decision in 2001 that said that you must show intent to discriminate in public facilities. You can't just rely on evidence of disparate impact. So even though there have been kind of copycat bus riders unions, they don't have that. They can kind of agitate, but they don't have that lever to bring the powerful people to the table and make a deal, which is what the bus riders union had been able to do, because its efforts were before the change in the law. So let me just sum up and say, so my central argument is that we have these strong subnational policies for separating people by race and income. It now extends out into the suburbs. And we have a lot of places with very weak service infrastructure, lots of barriers, physical barriers, and very weak national levers. Federal government is not doing much to help build a new infrastructure to match with this new political geography. It's not doing much to help connect places through transit. And it's filled with a lot of misplaced language about how people should be self-sufficient, when actually what government is doing is putting barriers in their way of becoming self-sufficient. So this is a pretty miserable conclusion, and I didn't want to end there. So I want to end with some ideas about, you know, how can you think over some longer term about remedying this disjuncture. And so I just want to talk about a couple of different things. And the first is what I would call filling the vertical gaps. And part of what I mean here is that the state government, state legislatures have been critically important in failing to respond to the new political geography, and in most cases they've facilitated it. And the states in that picture I showed you about the New Deal coalition, basically the New Deal coalition was local governments and the federal government. And the states were not a good arena for these kinds of forces that wanted to promote more equality. And the idea was just try to get around them by having this federal relationship. But conservative interests have been much more focused on the state. If you know the organization ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a conservative organization, has really begun organizing in the states in the 1970s. And progressive organizations that want to try to address this inequality have got to start filling in the gaps and focusing on the state level. There are some organizations like that. They're much weaker than their conservative counterparts, but that would be a critically important thing. Mayors could also do a lot more, and I think some of the progressive mayors like de Blasio understand that they have a role. They get in trouble a little bit at home for focusing too much outside the city, but that they have a role in representing what the interests and needs of low-income people are at higher levels of government. A second thing is to create new policy levers. I mean, if we're going to, we are, the old world of urban policy that was based on mayoral power is really never going to come back. And what we're going to have now are local advocates trying to do things. And the more higher levels of government can put a thumb on the scale and make their work easier through things like requirements for participation, various kinds of regulations that might limit what other actors can do, are things that could change some of the some of what's happened. There are examples. Clinton had an order 20 years ago around environmental justice that did allow some local organizations to get much more power than they otherwise would have had. The Community Reinvestment Act is actually the best example of this, where local groups were able to use it to stop redlining. Finally, things like trans-local issue campaigns. So thinking about creating capacities across that are more horizontal but across the United States. And the so-called Fight for 15 to the minimum wage is an example of this. And labor has become very interested in it. Organized labor is not that much a part of my story because, in fact, organized labor in most places at the city level had a relationship with business and was just pro-development. The national level, it was very progressive. It had a pretty different set of priorities at the local level. And but now you're seeing labor engaging in very different ways with local politics. And so these kinds of, and it has the capacity to implant campaigns in different kinds of geographic areas. So I think that is another way to think about a more hopeful future. And then finally, mobilizing new groups into politics. Los Angeles is often looked at as a model that has built a new progressive local presence that's anchored in the labor movement, but also in the mobilization of immigrants and getting immigrants to become citizens and getting them to vote. And of course, there are still many, many more out there, and getting them into the political process could really begin to make a significant difference in American politics. And here's where I will mention Trump. He may serve as a spur that will actually push American politics in a more hopeful direction. And what I want to say just in closing is that it's really our politics that has created this disjuncture between the national and the local and kind of left low-income people in the vice that that has created, and creating new politics is what it's going to take to get out of it. So thank you very much.
So Margaret, that's great. Well, we have a mic here, but I don't think we really need it. We'll open it up to questions. Are there hands? I have a couple questions myself. Why don't we start here, and then we'll go back. Right here.
About 2 years ago, an American by the name of Linda Tarando came over to the LSC and spoke regarding a book she had written. It was called From Hand to Mouth. And she was unusual in the sense that she had dropped out. She was quite educated. She had dropped out of university, and she had become part of the urban poor. And having read her book, it spurred me into thinking about the issue of how one escapes from being part of that cohort. And I went on to read people like Aaron Reich's Nickel and Dime, and then more recently Robert Putnam's Our Kids. And just now in the bookshop, I saw a book called Evicted by And my question is, I know you haven't spoken about on an individual, you want to get away from the individualism, but how it's become virtually impossible for people to escape, I would have thought. You haven't really spoken about employment other than the $15 issue, but also education. It's part of your background, especially on education. Could you talk about what's happening in the urban areas regarding the charter schools?
Right.
And how that, the Republic is always going on about, the American dream. Just if you get educated, work hard, it will happen. But it's not happening.
Right. Should I answer, or should we collect a couple?
I was going to collect a couple. I guess not. Back in the... Could you first introduce yourself and then ask
your question? Yeah, sure. I'm actually an American here on holiday, but I've heard about this and I've checked it out. Can you talk, in regards to the states, what are your thoughts in regards to the capture by Republicans of the majority of state legislatures and the seeming endurance of it, and also the kind of corruption even state legislatures on both sides of the aisle, such as with Sheldon Silver in New York, and just how that applies to your suggested model of using states for future development.
Why did you not talk about factors outside America?
Can you speak up?
Why did you not talk about global factors, things that would be argued to shape the economic inequality?
Okay, so I'll start with the is there a way out? And I think the idea of a way out is that you need a robust public sector, and that is exactly what we don't have. And then because local governments are so important in the U.S., when you have places that have low fiscal capacity and low organizational capacity, or high fiscal capacity, but they don't want to spend it on low-income people, you're not going to get a robust public sector that will kind of provide this cushion given the labor market that we have. And I'm sort of holding the labor market, I can't write about everything, I'm sort of holding the labor market as it is and thinking, in this labor market, what do people need? What kind of services do they need? What kind of access do they need, et cetera? So I think that's precisely the point, that we have this reduced public sector that doesn't provide enough means of. I would say a couple of things. And education is obviously one of the critical things. I'll say a couple of things about education. In my very poor suburbs, the extrusion places, and in the containment places, the cities, you know, have very, very poor public schools, in part because that's the legacy of those places, and it's very difficult to graduate from those places and find and, you know, go on and go to university, and the decent jobs that you used to be able to get with just a high school education are no longer there. The thing that's happening in cities is that the charter school movement in some ways is, it's a very mixed bag, because in some ways it's pushed as a way to break up a monopoly of public teachers and to have better schools. It's not clear totally breaking, you know, breaking it is the answer. And charter schools has also really become an arm of gentrification. So in Chicago, charter schools have, you know, led to the closing of all these schools in black neighborhoods. Schools are one of the few institutions left in some of these neighborhoods. The same thing has happened in Philadelphia. So, you know, it deprives a neighborhood of an institution that once existed. I don't disagree that those schools need a lot more reform, and a lot more could be done, but I think just having this idea that breaking it and creating charter schools all over the place, and some limited number might be good for creating alternative examples of how to do education. So I think that charter schools, unfortunately, have been pushed as ways to promote promote gentrification more than to provide opportunity. The other thing I would say about education, and states vary a lot by this, is how good is their community college system and how good is their public education system. So I taught for 18 years at UC Berkeley, and I have to say that is an example of a system that was built for upward mobility, that has, there's a three-tiered system of schools there, starting with community colleges. And there is a pathway from the community colleges into the UC, you know, to the higher levels of UC system. And so it is a channel for upward mobility. The problem is it's a channel that is under severe strain. All public universities in the U.S. are under severe strain. And one of the ways that they deal with it is by taking more students from out of state as a way to beef up their finances. And so, and, you know, the UC system will tell you, no, we haven't hurt California residents, but you can see it, Temple University in Philadelphia, real shift to not people from Philadelphia, more and more people from outside the place. So as these institutions get weaker, they're less able to fulfill that role of upward mobility. I want to say one thing about the segmented suburbs. So these kind of segmented suburbs that have big, you know, where you have homeowners associations and weak public sectors, the one thing that's good about them is their public education systems. And they are potentially a positive light in low-income people that live in some of these segmented suburbs can go to good suburban schools. The question is how much they're segmenting those schools and channeling people. And I know there's a couple of lawsuits in some of the cases I'm looking at challenging, you know, saying that they're actually sticking people into schools based on race and based on their income. So they do present some possibility, because it's the one thing that they have valued is public education. So I turn to the states are corrupt. The states are corrupt. You know, I started a long time ago looking at this, doing interviews with state legislators, kind of a related project. And one of the state legislators that I interviewed in 2000 was Barack Obama, who was the representative from this friend of mine, said, oh, you got to talk to him, he's really great. And then people afterwards have said to me, you know, oh, did you know he was going to be president? Could you tell? And I said, you know, the level of the state legislators that I talked to was just like so you know, so not hot, I don't want to be mean, but that, yeah, he seemed great, but I couldn't quite have predicted he'd be, you know, I mean, he was just so different and thoughtful and, you know, from that I couldn't have predicted he'd be president because, I don't know, the category of people he was in. But, you know, but his state legislators, and, I mean, you know, Illinois is way worse than New York. I mean, it's really, it's right up there on the corruption. It's a huge problem in American politics that states have so much power, and they are such weak polities in that sense. They're often corrupt. They're, you know, in this area that I'm looking at, you know, a lot of the real estate industry has enormous power in the state legislature. The whole building industry has enormous power in state legislatures. So it's really, that's one of the reasons it's so hard to stop those exit opportunities, because you're up against really powerful interests and quite corrupt state legislatures. I wrote a paper a long time ago based on some of those interviews, and the thing that struck me is that you had, you know, Republican mayors of places who are going to the state legislatures and saying, you know, we need help. We have to deliver. And the legislatures were so ideological that they weren't interested, even the kind of the party ties didn't work to connect them in that way. So I hear you on state politics, but nonetheless, they are an arena that can't be overlooked. I think it was a weakness of the New Deal coalition that it skipped over that state level rather than really try. I mean, changes were made. The states are way different than they were, you know, in the 1950s. But there needs to be much more attention to the state level to hopefully correct their, you know, the corruption and weak governance in a lot of states. Yeah, and it's bipartisan. It's not it's equal opportunity. Global factors. I feel like I already had a lot of things in this talk, so I don't. What I would say about global factors, I mean, they are certainly a part of the story because they make places change. So deindustrialization is clearly, which is related to globalization, is clearly part of the story for why you have emptied out suburbs south of Los Angeles, emptied out suburbs south of Chicago. I mean, that was an industrial area. It was steel. It was steel in particular. So deindustrialization is and globalization in that sense is a precursor to place creation that I'm looking at in this project. And certainly, I think, I don't know, I am serious that I think it's how much can I say about globalization. I have to kind of focus on the pieces that I'm focusing on, but I do think that it's interesting that kind of free trade is being questioned on the right and the left in the U.S. today, and kind of the benefits of free trade and the lack of benefits of free trade for a lot of places and a lot of people.
Well, go ahead. So why don't we start down there? Yeah, go ahead.
Andrew, because I interrupted you briefly, you said, I mean, I find this fascinating work, and can I just imagine how much time you have to spend on this. But on your classification, I actually think it's not a problem with the vertical, but slightly with the horizontal, which you call organizational and political endowments. Endowments always suggests to me it's a given, and it's not politically created, while all your analysis actually tells us that, you know, there may be communities that, I think David almost indicated, that they starve their community, the county or whatever, even though these would be people, if you could tax them, there would be huge fiscal capacity, but there are political mechanisms through which they organize and make sure that what is collectively provided has a great chance to be provided if it's the more private it is for these people and then exclude the poor. And that relates to the second thing that I noticed. You use inequality and poverty almost interchangeably. And I think it would help if you take the inequality more seriously, because inequality has a bottom and a top, and the two are related to each other, and make more in your political analysis of that. And then I think it's a great scheme to help a bit.
Yeah, I could change the word endowments. I mean, I don't think of it as something that's fixed at all. Although there are certain historical legacies that, you know, I kind of alluded to, like what happened during the Progressive Era, what type of government was created. I didn't want to get into the weeds, but governments that in the South and the West that created reform-style governments, they don't have local political parties. They eliminated those. They never created this kind of relationships between politics and parties and nonprofit organizations because of their history of political reform. So there is a way, I'll think about your issue, but there is a way in which distinctive histories have created these distinctive organizational features of place. And of course, most suburbs were created for middle-income people. So their histories are very different. And, you know, they, in a way, need to be retrofitted for a more diverse population. So how do you think about doing that retrofitting? So there is a way in which something that is fixed does make sense, but it's a historical legacy. But I take the point that these things are created and not created. What was your other point?
Inequality.
Yeah, here's what I would say. I mean, I'm interested in divisions across space that I would think of as spatial inequalities, and within that, on a lot of the data that I presented has poverty, but what I'm actually more interested in kind of going up to like 1.5 times the poverty level. So people fall, you know, the thing we know about the American poverty level is people fall in and out of poverty. And so the group of people who may benefit from these variety of organizations and institutions is much larger than the people who are just in poverty at a single time. So I did some of it with sort of 1.5 or 2 times the official poverty level to get a sense of, you know, what do, you know, working people who are in low-wage jobs, who may be just above the poverty levels. That's what I have in mind, and I think I need to kind of clarify that. There's, you know, I have a place in the opening chapter where I try to signify this is the group of people I'm interested in. But I don't know what to say exactly about the top. It seems to me that people who study inequality, you know, they focus on different things. I was commenting a while ago on a conference, and the thing that struck me was about inequality is that some people only focus on the 1%. All the action is the 1%. And it's true, that's where the growth has been, this, you know, huge growth. But if you look at the work that, you know, Raj Chetty, some of you might know the work of Raj Chetty, who's tried to show where there's mobility, which places have mobility and what kind of mobility, he says the difference is really between, you know, the people in the lower, I can't remember exactly what he said, but it's among, you know, the lower one-third and the within that's the key difference. Like, can you make that jump from the bottom 20% a little higher, and that jump is hard to make. So I don't, you know, I mean, maybe one way to focus on it is to think about what the role of upper middle class people, so maybe people in that, the people who are marrying each other in Bob Putnam's book, and what their role is in wanting everything to be provided privately and kind of exiting and separating themselves from the public sector. Because that's actually something new. I mean, those kinds of people used to have exclusive suburban areas, and now many of that were public. And now many of them have kind of separated out to the private sector. So, I don't know exactly what you mean, but that it seems to me that given what I'm interested in, it's not the 1% so much as it is sort of the upper middle class and what they do that affects the organization of space and collective goods within public space. So.
There's a question right here.
Would you say that, like, going forward with the goals that you have, it would be a good idea to use, like, a new relationship between the local and the federal level to push for more, like, more organization or greater density within our cities? Because I grew up in L.A., which is, like, very spread out. I felt the chokehold, I guess, urban sprawl has on the community and how it makes everyone further away from each other and makes it more easy to separate communities by racial divide. And I was wondering if we could have, like, cities that are denser, like we have around here right now in London, then there would be less of an offer, like,
you could have more mixing of people by income. You know, New York City does have that, although it's really, you know, it's really under siege. And it's just because New York City is the only place in the United States where public housing was actually a viable form of housing, because they did put state money into it. Everywhere else, it was not good and not a viable form of housing. And now the question is, can they maintain their public housing as New York gets more and more gentrified? But, you know, but that's exactly the issue. What determines how space is organized and whether you have more density is really an issue that's about how you control land use and what the laws around land use are and zoning, and those are controlled by state and local governments. And it's sort of a funny thing. I think the pattern we have in the United States is that we do have more density in some cities, and if you look at what Bloomberg did in New York, and he approved a lot of zoning that goes higher and more density, and they've attached affordable, you know, that's how they do affordable housing. If you build, you can get a exemption from or a variance from the zoning and go higher if you also agree to build affordable housing. So we have some of that, but we don't, because that's good for politicians in cities. The thing we don't have is anything that stops the spread out. So we have this weird, when people talk about smart growth, and mayors love to talk about it. You know, smart growth, we're going to be smart growth people. They love to talk about it. But the piece that we have in the U.S. is density that's associated with gentrification. We don't have the piece that controls development on the outskirts that then would, you know, kind of force people to say, well, I guess I'll stay in this neighborhood and work to make it better. So it's this kind of schizophrenic policy of smart growth.
I don't care from the University of Sussex, where I'm a history student, so I'm a little out of my element, but what do you see, and not to get too much into the fantasy world of what comes next, but which do you see as the mechanism of either government or politics that might shift us more towards these more progressive things? I mean, is it going to be the magical new ninth member of the Supreme Court reinstating the Voting Rights Act? Is it going to be the massive upswelling of political revolution that Bernie Sanders is talking about? Where should I look for hope?
What?
A strong executive who wants to try and do.
You need a Congress. I guess I would say a couple of things. I think the political mobilization of immigrants in the United States is this critical, critical piece. You know, it transformed California politics. In the 1980s, California, and don't forget Ronald Reagan was governor of California. California had pretty conservative politics, and then they tried to pass this proposition 187 that was very unfavorable to immigrants, and it really got people mad, and it really ended up changing California politics and ended people's and governors' political careers. So I have to say, I think, you know, one of the things you see is that American democracy, especially local democracy, is so much weaker because we have so many undocumented immigrants in places. So you can get places that do that towing strategy in Waukegan. And you get places like Bell, California. You know about Bell, California? It was a small suburb, largely undocumented, heavy presence of undocumented immigrants. The city council members who were part-time were paying themselves $100,000. The city manager was paying himself $800,000 a year. And nobody was looking. It went on for years. So, you know, there was no local democracy there. So I think mobilizing immigrants is critical. The other thing is a kind of a geography issue, which is, you know, some people say our problem with our presidential elections elects a different electorate than elects the Congress. And some people say, well, it's gerrymandering. But I think that, you know, the latest on this that I read is that not gerrymandering is a small part of it, but it's also that the population has sorted itself out in a way that creates, you know, too many, you know, an oversupply of Democrats in some places and undersupply in other places. So I think, you know, that I imagine will shift over time, and I think that's going to be an important part of it, because you have to get a Congress that's willing to work with the president to rethink. We're never going to go back to that older pattern. You know, under Clinton, people were saying, oh, so great, there's a Democrat, we should have a Marshall Plan for the cities, have a whole, finally. And, you know, that didn't happen. And so it needs to be rethought in different ways. And, you know, that's something the president and the Congress have to do together. It can't be done just by executive order.
I'm thinking on that somewhat hopeful note that maybe we should call it here. Margaret, I want to thank you for coming to share your work. It's a great project.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this event brought to you by the U.S. Center at the London School of Economics. For more events and podcasts, visit lse.ac.uk/United States.